Welcome to Real Vision. It's Friday, January 22nd, 2021, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington, joined shortly by our co-founder and CEO, Raul Pell. But first, with the day's stories, Jack Farley.
Thanks, Ash. All three major U.S. stock indexes opened down, but the Dow declined the most, as much as 220 points. Over half of this decline in the Dow was due to IBM, which yesterday reported that it missed its earnings goal by 30%. It not only failed to meet the bottom line, it failed to meet the top line as well, with revenues below expectation, and they actually fell for the fourth quarter in a row. Interestingly, IBM is one of 11 companies in the S&P 500 that has already missed its quarterly sales estimates for 2021, and we're only 22 days in. Commodities were down today almost across the board, with U.S. Treasuries rallying and inflation breakevens taking the foot off the gas. In the credit markets, as spreads continue to narrow, some investors are turning to leveraged loans. Institutional managers like BlackRock and DoubleLine have indicated that they're selling some of their bonds and putting that money into loans. That's a way to monetize a view that interest rates will rise because loans, unlike most bonds, tend to be floating rate. Interestingly, we saw a tremendous inflow into BKLN, which is the biggest leveraged loan ETF. So some investors may be following suit. In economic news, the U.S. Purchasing Managers Index reported strong growth in economic activity. For manufacturing, they reported a 59.1 against 56.5 expected. For services, a 57.5 against a 53.4 expected. Remember, for PMIs, a number above 50 implies net expansion, and a number below 50 implies net contraction. Meanwhile, across the pond, France and Germany reported PMIs that were truly anemic, heightening concerns about a European double-dip recession. In the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Boris Johnson indicated that the new B.1.17 strain could in fact be more deadly. England's chief scientific advisor, Patrick Vaillant, said that for 1,000 men in England above the age of 60, the original COVID-19 virus would kill 10, so 10 out of 1,000. This new variant, he said, would kill 13 or 14. Now, this is obviously grim news. Generally, it's thought that transmissibility and fatality go in opposite directions. So to learn that this new variant is not only more transmissible, but also more deadly is not good. That's all for me. Now, let's go back to Ash and Raul.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Thanks, Jack. Welcome, Raul.
Good to be here as ever. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Always good to have you back. It's been a while. Lots has been going on. What's on your mind right now?
So yeah, Ash, I've got a lot of things I'm looking at. The key one right now is something that I wrote about in Macro Insiders. And I've got a couple of things I've written about in GMI Macro Insiders that I want to bring up with you because I think they're really interesting. But the core one I wrote yesterday in Macro Insiders in Real Vision Pro was the Wile E. Coyote moment. It's the thing that I've talked about with you and Ed for a while, flagging that the virus increase is coming, Christmas was going to be bad. We've seen that in retail sales. And then we come into this quarter and things are going to be much worse than expected. So myself and Remy, who works with me at GMI and was a co-founder of Real Vision, we've been using some charts, using just some basic growth rates of virus, and it's been extraordinarily good at tracking the virus growth and where it's going. And using that data, this is the shocking thing. We've had globally 2 million deaths from this virus so far. In the next 3 months, we're going to get 2 million more. This is the nature of an exponential trend. So the vaccine obviously is rolling out, but it's not going to really affect this quarter. So I think the US deaths, I know Biden had talked about potentially 500,000 deaths by the end of February. I think that's right. And if you extrapolate that trend, I think you get to 600 or 700,000 deaths by kind of April. So this is a big acceleration because we're basically doubling in 3 months all the deaths we've had worldwide everywhere. Now, we're seeing some encouraging signs in the UK where it's starting to ease off a bit, but we're not sure from the work we've done that that is going to last long. We're seeing a system of shutdowns. We've seen some news in Hong Kong. Obviously, the UK has said it's not going to reopen probably till March or April. Germany, I think, is closed till April. And I think we're going to see this around the world. We're seeing it also in Spain. And I think, you know, Japan is seeing incredible virus growth. And so there's a number of concerning spots for this. The US is obviously probably the most concerning of all because its prevalence for the virus right now. So with the Biden administration coming in, the chances of them having to try and force some restrictive measures in some way that they were able to do so, because the states get the choice in the US, I think that's high. And I think that it's going to hit consumption. It's going to hit earnings forecasts for many companies who are looking for that V-shaped recovery from this point out. I think it's going to stall for a while. So I've been looking at the signal, and I've talked about this before, is 2-year bond yields. They're currently at 12 basis points. If they break 10 basis points, it's tested that level about 3 times. If it breaks, bond yields in the US at 2 years will probably go to 0 or maybe even negative. Mm. I'm also seeing the dollar showing signs of reversal. It could get stronger, which is generally a risk-off scenario as well. So I'm watching these very closely. We'll wait and see what happens here. But if it does, it's likely to hit the equity market as well. So I'm on high alert now. So I've been flagging this for a while, saying it's coming. And now I'm on high alert that we could get a much more risk-averse market than we've been used to.
Yeah. Rao, some truly shocking numbers there. There's enough information to talk about it for 4 hours, but I'm curious, the first thing that struck me, the human cost of what you were talking about, obviously 2 million deaths, a key global threshold. Your modeling suggests that what we've seen over the last 12 months effectively could happen again in the next quarter. That's truly staggering, and that's the nature of exponential growth. Tell us a little bit about that data modeling.
So it's not a complicated data model. So we're not building, you know, virus spread rates or anything. All we're doing is we took 3 trend rates, saying 0.5% growth, 1% growth, 1.5% growth, and just watch how it tracks. And it's pretty linear. It just follows the path. Yeah. Now, places that have had the new variant, we've seen an acceleration where they've moved from one growth rate to another. The US has always stuck at the top growth rate because of the least restrictive measures. And that's why they've got the most number of virus cases, and simple as that, and that they've got the most number of deaths. Yeah. But it is shocking to me that we have a probability. Again, it's just a very simple trend-based model. We have a probability of doubling all of the deaths we've had. And that is terrifying.
Yeah. Shocking and terrible human cost, and also great economic cost. Ralph, for people who aren't as familiar with these data models as you are in terms of thinking about the lag between an impact to the real economy and the financial economy, tell us a little bit about how that plays out and what the duration is that we can expect to see these things in the data.
Well, the data, I mean, we've seen the retail sales numbers for Christmas. We've got this weird economy where housing's going through the roof as people are moving out of cities based on the same thing. But we've got retail sales that I was flagging to people were going to disappoint because there was no Christmas in most places around the world.
Right.
So we see that. My real issue here, my real concern is not what it does to Apple shares. Yes, they may see some slowdown in growth. Some spending was brought forward. We've got some stimulus coming. We don't yet know the form of it. But my fear is the insolvency of the small to medium sized business. That's always been my fear here. It's the average guy gets screwed. So this is why handouts are so important, even though, you know, it means more monetary printing and more bad things. What else are you going to do? Now, again, I've argued many, many times that you basically have the same issues whether the government restricts or not, because people take evasive action, so right. all these small businesses fail. And so another 3 to 6 months of business shutdowns and slow growth, I mean, that's devastating for middle America, where most of the jobs are. So I think the job numbers, and we're seeing that, are going to be less robust than people hope for. I think there might be a second round of layoffs, a second round of insolvencies, as companies just can't afford to pay their bills any longer. And so that tends to draw back consumption, rise savings, as people just get a little bit more nervous. Yeah. Let's see what happens with the next handout. My guess is that it'll probably be saved again and not spent. And I would argue that's probably a good thing to do for the time being, is, you know, save the money to ride out any hardship that may come, as opposed to spend it on house, you know, on your house, on bits and pieces. I do think some of it creeps back into markets, because if you're young in your 20s and 30s and you've not had a chance to invest, somebody giving you a $1,000 check or a $2,000 check actually gives you a good opportunity to invest in markets. Hopefully it won't be as speculative, but my guess is it will be equally as speculative as last time. And my guess is it probably spills into the crypto markets this time.
Why stop now?
Why stop now with what?
With the speculative fervor in crypto markets.
Well, you know, if you're 30 years old, you can afford speculation.
Yeah.
Because if over time you just put money into the market, yeah, you bought some top ticks, but maybe in 10 years, those top ticks look a long way behind you. So, you know, that's not the end of the world. But, you know, if you're a retiree and you stick your money in at all-time highs, record high valuations, record high levels of speculation that we've got in the equity markets now, right now, that's right. not a good idea.
NASDAQ, obviously, at all-time highs. In crypto, we saw Bitcoin, for example, crack 20,000 just in December. Now in January, it goes up through 42,000, new all-time high, retraces about 33% down to 28,000 at the low in the last couple of weeks here. It's a whipsaw.
Yeah, and I've told people about this, is you do not get the kind of crazy upside you get in Bitcoin without the downside volatility.
Yeah.
32% corrections are very standard. In 2017, it had about four of them. In 2013, it had a 45% correction. That needs to be taken in context with the upside. So people need to understand what this asset looks like. It's very volatile, but it has a very skewed risk reward. So, you know, I've been personally adding, so over time, and I've talked about this, I added Ethereum and then I've added more Ethereum as I think that the people start moving out the risk curve. So Bitcoin is the safe asset. Ethereum is the next least risky asset, but has a bit more risk characteristics. So in a bull market, tends to outperform. And then the next phase of that is the alts, which are the smaller market cap tokens and coins that tend to be very speculative. Mm-hmm. But within them, there's actually some very decent products, projects, protocols, tokens that usually outperform massively. So if I think about how I think about it, I think Bitcoin could do another 10x from here over the next 12 months. Ethereum could do 20x. You can see that in the Bitcoin Ethereum chart itself. If it breaks this 0.04 level, it's at 0.037 right now, breaks that, that's a big inverse head and shoulders rounded bottom. So that would suggest Ethereum outperforms. So it could do double what Bitcoin does. Some of these alts could do 50x. So, but they're riskier. So you have to allocate smaller amounts of capital. The wrong game is what many people do, is like, they're going to go up more. I'm going to put all my money into those. No, that's how to go broke. Yeah. The way is to think, can I get some extra alpha, some juice out of my trade by getting slightly out on the risk curve and changing my asset allocation a bit? So that's how I think about it. Trying to keep a portfolio which is mainly Bitcoin, then a good chunk of Ethereum, and then a small speculative thing that could pay off well if it works. But if it doesn't work, it doesn't hurt me much.
Right. You know, talking of altcoins, Raoul, lots of activity on your Twitter feed the last few days.
So I knew, because I flagged it danger, I asked people, because I don't know much about this altcoin space. I know some, like Polkadot and Link, and, you know, we've featured them on Real Vision Crypto. Yeah. But I want to know more. And I have no idea what to buy. You know, it's the interview with Ari Paul that I did, that I know you've interviewed as well recently on the podcast. Yeah. Ari was talking about, you know, that it's called alt season, when alts start to outperform as people go further out the risk curve. And that happens in credit markets, equity markets, emerging markets, everywhere. That's how humans allocate risk capital. So he was talking about that it's coming up, and they were discussing internally how to build, how to play it. And he talks about just having an equally weighted basket. And I thought, you know, that's the simplest thing. What do I put in the basket? I really don't know. So I thought I'd reach out on Twitter. I didn't imagine I'd have the most engaged tweet I've ever had, and probably one of the most responses of any financial tweet on Twitter I've ever seen. I mean, thus far, I've had 5,500 replies to that question as everybody shilled me their coins. But yeah. I said, give me a paragraph on why the coin that you're suggesting is good for this basket. Really interesting responses. I mean, obviously wildly overwhelming. Yeah. But, you know, a lot came up. Stuff like Cardano, Link, Uniswap. There's a whole bunch of the ones that we kind of know, many of which we featured on Real Vision Crypto. But, you know, I'm interested in, you know, if they all fall by 50%, I don't really care. It's a few percent, you know, and, you know, Bitcoin, you know, having fallen like that is now up 7.5% today. So, you know, losing a few percent in alts by getting it wrong, not going to kill me. But if they go up 50x, yeah, it'll make a lot of money.
Well, it's what we always talk about on this show, asset allocation.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So, you know, so I'm pretty set with that. You know, it's again, I've always said it's a very big position for me. So it's supposed to be terrifying, but I actually get excited when the sell-offs happen, because if I can find any cash under the sofa, I just stick it back into that market. So I actually look forward to sell-offs, because in this kind of volatile market, those sell-offs are your friend until they're not. The difficulty is deciding when they're not your friend any longer, when the trend has turned. How I think about that is, I wrote an article for GMI that was published in Real Vision Pro this week, which I think is one of the most important articles I've ever written, maybe the most important article I've written about cryptocurrencies. It's going to be released free on Real Vision Crypto next week. So anybody who's watching it, you'll see this article. And it basically talks about network effects and Metcalfe's law and how you value cryptocurrencies most like a social media platform as opposed to a commodity. And so that's a little bit revolutionary in thinking, because it actually shows that something like Ethereum is actually very similar to Bitcoin, but it just started 5 years later. So it's following basically Bitcoin's path 5 years ago. It's truly extraordinary how similar they are. And it's to do with network effects, the number of wallets and a bunch of other stuff. Within that, I talk about S-curves as well. So S-curves in businesses is you get the network effect or the growth phase, and then it tends to tail off. And then you either have to kind of reinvent yourself, invent new products, change your business, and you get the next S-curve up, or you can fail. Now, I was thinking this through. Once I was discovering this, I was thinking, okay, well, why does crypto have these big sell-offs? The halving cycle, the network effect increases, the wallet addresses increases, the prices rise, the market caps go up. Why the big sell-off? And it dawned on me, it's pretty simple. Even though everybody says they're a holder or a hodler, the reality is at some point you actually want to transfer back into fiat to cash in your cash in your crypto chips for lifestyle chips. And the lifestyle chips happen to be US dollars, because that's how you buy a house, a car, put your kids through school, or anything else. So you have to go back into the regular economy. So most people say, oh, we don't do that. We're waiting for the Bitcoin ruling the world. The reality is, if you get a chance to buy your house or buy a car, you'll take it. So what happens is, as a few people get to the point where they think, okay, this is ridiculous, I've now made so much money, I want to start cashing in some crypto chips or lifestyle chips, right, it starts pushing everybody towards that. And what you do is you unwind a significant portion of the rally that's come before it. So it's just normal human behavior. And I think that's all that drives it, is when it becomes worth so much that your $5,000 is now worth $100,000, well, you might want to cash in that $100,000 for something else.
Yeah. And this is why that market experience, Rao, that you bring to this is so important. It's understanding this and seeing it in other cycles. As the highs get lofty, people decide to cash in those chips. That further pushes down price, accelerating other people to think, I want to get out before I don't get the opportunity to buy the house that Joe down the street bought with his crypto. And then it reaches a certain new equilibrium and people go, you know, at that level, I'm actually willing to come back in. And that's the give and take. That's the push and pull. That's what makes markets so fascinating.
Yeah, because Bitcoin is the network effect of money, it's got kind of behavioral properties that are so strong because unlike Facebook, which also works via Metcalfe's law, famously so,
yeah,
your incentivization is to get your friends on it, or it was originally, to get your friends on it so then you can keep in connection with them. Well, Bitcoin is a similar network effect, but when you get your friends onto it, the value goes up. So your money goes up. I mean, this is genius.
Yeah.
This is the best alignment of behavioral incentives almost ever invented. But it does come with that negative down cycle as well when people want to get off. People don't do that with Facebook. So the network effect tends to grow and there's no S curve.
Right.
Yes, you might get some growth S curves as people get bored of Facebook and they need to introduce new things, but you don't get the violent S curve that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies get. But this whole piece is going to be, it's going to create quite a lot of pushback and debate in the space because it slaughters some holy cows within this. that Bitcoin is different to Ethereum. It's not. They both look identical. When you actually use the same number of wallet addresses as your starting point, they both were exactly the same price. And they both have followed exactly the same pattern. I mean, it's kind of spooky, which shows you it's more behavioral and the value is implicit in the network effect and not in the technology itself. The technology itself is what brings the network effect. So really interesting. It'll push a few narratives out about, you know, what's a shit coin and what's a quality investment. It's actually about how adoption rates work.
Yeah.
So and it rejects a lot of the arguments a guy called John Pfeffer wrote about this, that has been held onto within the Bitcoin community as all other coins trend to compute costs or electricity costs, except Bitcoin. It kind of disputes all of that in some very simple charts and some mind-blowing maths from Santiago Velez, who helped me out on some of it.
Always good to have a nuclear engineer helping you out with.
Yeah, I don't want to bore everybody about crypto, but the other thing that's coming out next week, I hope, on Real Vision Crypto is you'll have all heard me talk about we need to talk the language of the asset allocators if you want them involved, and to talk about, you know, all of the kind of philosophy and stuff behind Bitcoin doesn't work for them. They need to know how it works in a portfolio and portfolio effects and diversification effects. Well, I bleated on so long a Real Vision that somebody hit me up on LinkedIn and said, listen, I'm a Real Vision member. I used to work for Barra. I've worked for another one of these quant firms. I worked for BlackRock, and now I'm a consultant, and I do risk models. I'm like, could you write us a white paper? He said, sure. So he's written an incredible white paper that is going to massively leap forward the space's understanding of the portfolio diversification effects and the full portfolio effects, what it does to the volatility of the portfolio, the return profile, and everything else. And he's looked at it in a number of different ways. You know, reducing a currency component, putting it in that, putting it across broadly across the portfolio, reducing equity weights, looking at different outcomes. This is really what the institutional space has been after. So I'm, you know, really pleased. You know, it'll be come out with Real Vision, and I think it'll go around the world, and it should be a very important piece. So lots happening next week on Real Vision Crypto, my GMI piece, which I think will drive conversation and is a very important piece, if I'm honest. And this other piece is really important for institutional adoption because it talks the language of pension funds, insurance companies, and asset allocators, endowment funds, all of those people who really need to understand Bitcoin in a different way.
Everything a CFA charter holder could dream of in terms of portfolio construction theory.
Yeah, because it's actually complicated to do, but it's all been done. So we'll announce that fully next week. Not sure when that's going to come out. So.
You know, Raul, in terms of the GMI paper that's going to be released, you've already put some of those charts on Twitter, and the correlation that you found with these network effects is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, and I hadn't noticed that nobody talked about this before. I mean, people talk about Metcalfe's law and stuff, but there it's kind of writ large. So super interesting. So we'll wait and see. But, you know, outside of crypto, because we could talk about crypto all day, it's actually a boring macro landscape. And, you know, some people say to me on Twitter, why aren't you tweeting about macro stuff? I'm like, there's nothing going on. I'm just a friend of mine is a broker, fixed income derivatives broker. He's like, I've got nothing to do. Because fixed income's not really doing a lot. It's relatively low volatile. You know, we had that spurt up in yields. It stopped, done nothing. The short end of the curve's been drifting lower. And then everything from gold's been in a range. The dollar's been kind of sideways, looking, hopefully it goes higher. There's not a lot going on in macro land. But I know macro land is very focused on crypto land right now. Yeah. You know, everyone's super jealous of crypto land. So they're all, you know, I'm getting all my macro clients from GMI. All they're doing is asking about crypto. I mean, virtually nobody's asking me about macro. So yeah, it's very interesting. There's just not a lot going on. And I don't like that for an anchor to get involved in markets yet. You know, I've talked about emerging markets. I'm still waiting for the dollar to rise, emerging markets to sell off for a bit, maybe the equity markets overall to correct. Then we can see, okay, what's the reflation trade? What does it look like? What can we do? And I think that bet for me is going to be end up being a very big bet in emerging markets that will go on for some time. And we'll bring more emerging market content onto Real Vision so people can get up to speed, whether it's about India, whether it's about, you know, other countries that need to get to speed with. And it's going to be interesting because everyone's going to have a lot new learning. It's not just going to be about tech stocks. We're going to have whole countries, whole new economies, and a great macro landscape. So I'm excited about new opportunities coming up in this kind of dead period of macro right now.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Fascinating. Do you feel, Raoul, in a certain sense, that it's like the calm before the storm, like we're watching in this silent afternoon, the storm clouds roll in toward us and there's a big change that's coming?
I think there's a change that's coming. How big that is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I do note that future expected 10-year returns of US equities are like negative 10% now. I mean, they're about the worst they've ever been. Do those models play out? I don't know. I don't even know how to construct those models, but they all look interesting to me. So I see that. And I worry about developed market equities, and I have done for a while. And maybe that's wrong. Maybe I'm the fool, and the central bank printing makes it all go away. I'm not so sure. So I am on high alert for risk. I smell fire in the room. Can't see it yet.
13,543 NASDAQ closed today, all time, new 52-week high today.
Yeah. I mean, and this is, you know, again, I wrote about this in Macro Insiders. I mean, all-time record option speculation, all-time low mutual fund cash holdings, all-time record volumes on pink sheets, yeah, the most speculative stocks. You know, we're seeing speculative excess after speculative excess that is beyond what we even saw in 2000. So, you know, can bubbles go on? Of course they can.
Yeah.
And that's why I tend not to short a bubble, but I'm just cognizant of it. And I always say, bonds will give us the lead. They'll tell us what's going on. Right now, they're kind of doing nothing. So it doesn't really help us yet. But I've noticed that yields are drifting lower. You know, I've got the chart 5-year yields. They've been drifting lower a bit for recently. And 2-year yields are the one that I've been looking at the most.
Yeah. Question for you, Raoul, something that we've been talking about internally at Real Vision on our Slack channel. Many of our ideas for these shows come out of the conversations that we have all day long. You were talking earlier about the hardest lesson to learn in investing, and I thought this is a fascinating.
Yes, this is true, because I've been thinking about this. What have I found the hardest to do, and what has almost everybody, particularly in macro land, Macro and I were all cynics, right? That's our game is ambulance chasing. We look for we hear the sound of the ambulance. We try and, you know, get in front of the trend, particularly when it turns. What is interesting is everybody has to learn how to enter a trade, how to put stop losses, how to manage your risk, how to scale out of a trade, take some profits. All of these things, right? These are standard trading things. But a couple of times in your career, you catch an exponential trend. And exponential trends are so difficult to deal with. So Bitcoin is one of them. Everybody wants to tell you, to tell your position that you're wrong. This risk is going to happen. This risk is going to happen. You're going to lose it here. And all of those are real risks. And somehow you need to filter all those out without feeling sick and saying, no, I think it's going higher, and here's my reasons. And that is the hardest thing I've ever seen anybody to do. It's really hard. Macro people don't do it very well because they always get cynical too quickly. Some people, you know, people look at stocks like Microsoft or Amazon and say, look how much they rose. Virtually nobody, unless it's in a passive vehicle or some portfolio they didn't look at, ever rides those. Because at some point, Amazon's going bust. It's a terrible company. Look at its PE. It's trading on a PE of 800. You've got to get out, you know, and the market screams, get out, get out, get out, get out all the way. And the key to making the big bucks is not getting out. And that's terrifying because your fear is always, this is all going to go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. It's fighting the counter narrative in the crypto world. They call it FUD. What's it? Fear, uncertainty, and despair,
doubt.
So I've been a bond bull for basically my entire career, 30 years. All I've had to do is, Travis and I were laughing about this over Twitter. All I've had to do that whole career is do this, is you have to stop all the inflationists going, inflation is going to break out, wage inflation is going to rise, and it never happens. It's cyclical, then it disappears, and bond yields keep falling. But I've had to fight narratives for 30 years in this. So I know I can do it in bonds. I'm trying to do it now in crypto. And I've seen a few friends of mine who've ridden, you know, 100Xs. It's really difficult to do. It's I think, the most difficult trade of all.
Yeah. Look at that chart on the 30-year treasury yield. If you just go back, you know, I don't know, 1980, and just watch that yield.
It's just done this. It's just a one-way trend.
Yeah.
But even if you look at the Fed and Wall Street forecast, every year they do this. They're going, yields are going up, and they don't. And so you have to fight the narrative, because everyone calls me up, calls me an idiot. Usually at the beginning of the year, when everyone says, yields are going up, I'm like, they're probably not. And then what happens is I get called an idiot, and then yields fall again. And you can see it. It's a stair-step pattern as well. It's pretty clear. It's a big channel, stair-step, which is the cyclical part. And then as everyone goes, yields are going to break out. Remember Jeff Gundlach, yields are going to 6%. It's all the same thing. Everyone looks at that channel and projects a breakout of yields to the upside, and they never do. And I still don't think they're going to. And still we're hearing the inflation, MMT, currency printing, inflation. Right. And all I look at is that chart and say, that's the chart of truth. It's never let me down in 30 years. My guess is it lasts a little bit longer.
Yeah, you could have been a fixed income analyst in 1981 and said, this is my call. I predict 30-year treasury yields are going to fall, and that's going to happen for the next 40 years.
And isn't that Schilling? That was Schilling, right? That's what the bet he made. He made one bet, which is bond yields are going to fall, and he's got it right all the way through. So, but yes, and really, that's the biggest source of returns for the macro hedge fund industry. Because what's amazing about bond markets is they are low volatile, massively liquid, trade 24 hours a day, and you can get huge leverage, and it's massively trending. It's like that's the world's perfect trade. And they follow the economy. So it's not like you're trying to figure out the behavioral psychology, really. It basically follows the economy. So it's been a great source of returns. Problem is sure, maybe I'm right, bond yields fall to zero or negative 0.5%. That's one last push, and then it's dead. You know, there's nothing left. I talked about this with Ed last week. The kind of death of macro is real. that's the message I'm basically getting from the friend of mine who's the fixed income derivative guy. He's like, what am I supposed to do? You know, try being a Japanese government bond salesman for the last 20 years. You've had no job except answering the phone to the Bank of Japan saying, how many would you like today? That's it.
Yeah. You know, just flip the script here and talk a little bit about what some of those new durable rules may be. And obviously, this is speculative. And when you're thinking about it at the beginning of a trend that may be durable, you clearly don't know. But your interview with the Winklevoss twins, talking about some of the points that you made earlier about network effects and how this effectively what we see in the digitization of money looks like the digitization of attention in social media. Fascinating, fascinating theory.
Yeah, look, I think it's real. And then you need to understand why there are exponential trends. It's because of this. You know, other people say it's a bubble, but as many people have pointed out, a 12-year bubble doesn't look much like a bubble any longer. These exponential moves, that's network effect, and the S-curve is what we talked about before. Yeah. So if you can understand, okay, this is exponential, there is an S-curve, at what point do I get out of the at the top of the S-curve? How do I figure that out? Right now, I don't know yet, but I've got my price targets and my time targets. We've got the stock-to-flow chart from Plan B, and we've got a number of things that, again, you'll see in that article when it's released next week, gives you some guidelines. Again, I could be dead wrong, but so far it's been a good trade for everyone.
Yeah, and if you're looking for an introduction to S-curves, my interview with Brian Estes on Real Vision Crypto, absolutely fascinating. That was the key trend that he saw and by his own admission in terms of his description of how he got into his Bitcoin position and why he found it so interesting.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, super interesting. You know, there's a lot of new knowledge we're having to learn because here we are in the investing space having to learn what the technology guys had learned. Most of this network effect stuff was actually hidden at VC level before companies went public.
Yeah.
And they went public once they were up the risk curve, up the adoption curve. So many of us haven't dealt with this. VCs kind of intuitively understand it. So it's just a different way of thinking about this stuff.
Very different framework for
the other thing I write about in this piece is a lot of people complain about scams in the crypto space and these coins that come out and then collapse. I'm like, okay, what you're seeing here doesn't exist elsewhere, which is this is mark to market VC. If you mark to market Real Vision, it would have gone bust five times, it would have gone to zero about five times, right? You can't mark to market VC because it's terrifying because they're early stage businesses. The other problem with that, so you shouldn't really do that, which is why many of the people like Pantera buy and hold these tokens and don't think in those terms. But Novo raised a point to me that was really interesting in my interview with him on Real Vision Crypto. He's like, well, what I do is there's too much retail money in the space. So they see a new project that looks interesting. The price goes up so fast that it's well beyond any fair value. And what happens is the owners of the tokens and the founders of these companies are incentivized to sell because suddenly there's millions on the table instantly, which doesn't happen in startups. So what happens is new supply of coin comes out, the thing collapses. Bad projects fail, just like they do in VC startup land, right? 80% of projects fail. That's normal. It's not a scam. It's behavioral, but because you've got the stupid mark to market going on.
Yeah.
Then you've got the others that will ride through that S curve. So the downside of the S curve. And then as they get adoption and they build a proper business, their tokens start to be worth more. So it's common and it's explainable. And it's not everything as a scam. Of course, there's scams. There's scams in equity world. There's scams in gold mines. There's scams everywhere. Humans are humans. They'll try and make a buck. But the reality is it's behavioral, which I've been saying for a long time. All of this is a very, very behavioral space. And this ridiculous thing of having real-time mark-to-market on projects, which just doesn't happen elsewhere.
Right. Real-time mark-to-market, 24/7, 365 continually.
Yes, with excessive speculation that takes place in the space as well. So it becomes a really complicated market to deal with. But you have to have patience and time. Maybe the answer is you wait for the ramp and then bust and then buy the tokens that you think are going to last over time. And maybe that gives you a higher probability of success over time, or the ones that don't come down as far and then start moving, i.e. buy highs maybe that works too. I don't know. I'm still new to this space, trying to figure it out. Yeah. I've been talking to a lot of people about it. I was speaking to somebody very interesting yesterday. I can't really name names, who is very active in this space. And they're trying to figure it out too, because you know they run a VC fund, but they also run a crypto and token fund as well. And you know the differences in this are very different between how they hold it in the VC portfolio versus how they hold it in the normal portfolio, just because of how it is.
And now we've got leverage thanks to DeFi and futures.
Humans, they're gamblers by nature. You mm-hmm. can't stamp it out. People say we can build this great new financial system, won't look anything like the rest. I'm like, no, we're humans. We're just going to do excess leverage again and blow it all up again. But that's all we do. That's humans.
Yeah.
We get greedy. We want to make more money, and then we blow the whole thing up, and then we start all over again.
Well, it's so interesting because we're asking people to think about this universe in a totally different way. You know, for the last week or so, obviously this isn't an endorsement and not to the exclusion of any other really interesting projects that are out there, but I've just gone down the rabbit hole on Chainlink. I did an interview for the podcast Ground Floor Consensus that came out last week with Sergey Nazarov. Absolutely fascinating. This idea of oracles. If you aren't familiar with oracles, what oracles basically are, it's the interface that a smart contract has with the rest of the world. You and I create a smart contract that has to evaluate some condition. How do we establish whether that condition has happened or not? You and I bet on a Yankees game or on a football match. How do you know who actually won? It sounds trivial. It turns out in application, it's not trivial at all. That's what oracles are all about. That's what Chainlink is working on right now. And when you start to think about what that world looks like, again, there are other projects that are doing similar things. Lots of people are looking at this. But what's so fascinating is thinking about things like insurance contracts, programmatically being able to pay out.
So you're thinking of the nice applications that industry needs. I'm thinking everyone's going to bet on everything. Because you can create really complex bets like you can in derivative markets, but here you've got a distributed basically oracle to prove who won it. So you can create fantastically complicated bets, and humans being humans, yes, they'll put the insurance sector and everything else on it. They'll also put the gambling sector onto this.
Absolutely.
Because they can't help themselves.
Because they can't help themselves. Raoul, you and I have the best job in the world.
Yeah, especially on a Friday afternoon when you can have a good chat and laugh about what's going on in the world and also get excited. There's a lot going on. So not enough going on in macro land for me. So it's a bit like twiddling my thumbs for a while, but that's what macro's like. Nothing happens and then three buses all come along at once. But crypto land is keeping me reasonably engaged and just thinking through the space and learning, trying to apply different frameworks and helping bring others into the space to give them a level of understanding. You know, I'm enjoying doing that. So long may it continue.
Ralph, final thoughts as we head into the weekend and then the new week.
I have no final thoughts today. It's been a long, long week. And my final thoughts are, it seems to be cocktail hour. Do I have a siesta first or not?
It's a tough decision to make.
I know, but somebody's got to do it.
Ralph, thanks once again for joining us.
Thanks a lot. And thanks, everyone. Have a fantastic weekend.
Have a good weekend, everyone.